Hello, and welcome to episode 53 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. We're here today with Phil Kaufman, member of the Montgomery County Board of Education. How are you doing today, Phil?
I'm doing fine.
Excellent. So the first question I'd like to ask you is, what are you currently doing or what have you ever done to advance the public interest and why?
So I would say there are different things I've done. I'll start with actually my former job, where I worked for the Department of Veterans Affairs.
Okay.
I was a contract lawyer there, and we did contracting for healthcare services. And years ago, and I guess I'm now retired there, but Congress passed a law that had to do with how we contract for pharmaceuticals.
Mm-hmm.
And the VA actually buys the pharmaceuticals for the federal government, for both the civilian agencies, and also DOD buys off of VA contracts.
Hmm.
And it was a very strange law that was passed. It was one of these that where Congress was trying to do different things, and there was a sort of a compromise that was passed between a House version and a Senate version of a bill. It had to do with pricing on how we did contracting, and it created a concept called federal ceiling prices for contract for pharmaceuticals. It fell on my office to administer this particular law. I had a couple attorneys that were stationed in Chicago, and we basically created a program where over time we literally saved tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars in the prices that we paid for, the government paid for pharmaceuticals.
So that's actually really interesting, because I'm aware that the Medicare Modernization Act, passed in the early 21st century under the George W. Bush administration, created Medicare Part D and specifically prohibited the federal government, in this case, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, referred to as CMS, from the using the federal government's purchasing power to negotiate down prescription drug pricing. But what you're telling me is the Veterans Administration and
Department of Veterans Affairs.
Department of Veterans Affairs, and then by virtue of that, and by extension of that, the Department of Defense have actually done the very same thing, negotiating down prescription drug pricing using their hold on the market. Is that what you're saying?
Pretty much. And it was interesting because we were doing really great things. Depending on the administration, sometimes folks, there's this perception that the government can't do anything right.
Mm-hmm.
And
why is there that perception? Well, Ronald Reagan's
who knows?
Yeah.
There are those perceptions out there. But we were actually doing a really good job of negotiating with contractors and getting this pricing. But I would say that there was fear,
mm-hmm,
amongst the pharmaceutical makers. I mean, the federal government share is really that we buy directly,
mm-hmm,
is a small share. And the drug industry was willing to deal with VA, DOD for the drugs that the VA bought,
uh-huh,
that DOD bought for its direct beneficiaries for TRICARE and all. Periodically, the White House would call us in and say, how do you guys do this? Because there was a fear that the model we were using would be replicated for Medicare.
So which White House was this?
This is probably the Bush White House.
Okay.
Bush number two.
Okay.
And so we would explain how this all happened. Mm-hmm. But it stayed as a program really for VA buys and really direct government buys. It never got, and Medicaid sort of does something similar, but it was really just for the drugs that we bought. So, I mean, we felt pretty proud about the job that we did. It was with a relatively small staff in terms of, my office provided the legal advice,
mm-hmm,
on that.
So you're an attorney.
I'm an attorney. So I was a contract law attorney. That's what I did.
And you were an employee or a contractor?
I was an employee of the VA.
And did you get any recognition for saving taxpayers millions or tens of millions of dollars?
No, not really.
When
you retire, people say, okay, congratulations, you did a good job. And but no, there was never any, one of my staff attorneys was the guy. And, you know, so he periodically he would get recognized by DOD. He mm-hmm. would get different, and we allowed, it was fine in terms of the recognition. But anyway, so, I felt it's one of those things where you look at, okay, in my government career, that was, I'd say, a win. I felt like after I retired that I did something good from that.
So would you consider yourself to have been, or would you have considered yourself to have been a bureaucrat or a civil servant or category C, something else?
Well, I was a career employee.
All right.
So whether or not that's a bureaucrat, I would say that some people call that a bureaucrat, but I was just a career employee, mm-hmm. certainly not a political appointee.
How did you get involved with the Department of Veteran Affairs?
So after I graduated law school in 77, mm-hmm. I went to University of Maryland in Baltimore, where the law school is. Mm-hmm. I initially was hired by the Corps of Engineers, mm-hmm. and I did contract law there for a couple of years. And then, being an attorney in the field outside of Washington, the pay is not as great as it would be in the D.C. area. And I eventually, got a job doing contract law back in 1980 with the Department of Veterans Affairs and just moved here. And
ran the career.
And sort of was there for, 35 years.
Now, your career really politically pivots upon or is premised somewhat upon the idea that you have children and those children eventually received an education. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And so, there are many individuals who happen to have children and whose children go into the school system. In fact, at any given time, there are about 150,000 students in Montgomery County Public Schools.
Right now, 159,000.
159,000. And you roughly could say about 300,000 or so individuals are the parents of those students. And yet you ran for Board of Education. So many of those parents are not running for Board of Education, but you did. At what point did you realize that political office would be for you? What was the run-up to your decision to run? And what have you been able to accomplish?
So I'd say just going back, for that particular role as a public servant, all that, I got involved in schools as a PTA volunteer in my community. My children went to schools in the Alney area. And we were involved. When we first moved to Alney, it was sort of a tumultuous era for our area of the county in the Sherwood Cluster. There was a several-year process by which the folks in the Sherwood Cluster were lobbying for a new school to be built in the Sherwood Cluster.
Mm-hmm.
And
a new high school,
a new elementary school. A lot of growth in that area back then. And at the same time, there was a lot of, they were building a new high school, which became Blake High School. The new high school was to relieve overcrowding at Sherwood, Paint Branch, and Springbrook.
And what age were your children? So
my kids at that time were just in elementary schools.
Okay.
And so my focus really was, getting involved in the lobbying and the advocacy around the elementary school.
Why did you feel like you needed to get involved? If you would have just sat back, didn't you think someone else might take care of it?
There were lots of, friends and all that. It was just, our PTAs got involved. So I was part of the PTA and we were just all involved. Within the folks in our cluster in terms of going to Board of Ed meetings, county council meetings, just sitting there with our signs saying we needed a new elementary school.
We had
bumper stickers, Sherwood 6 and 96 and, and it ultimately it turned out that we didn't get the new elementary school.
So you became a disappointed civic activist.
I became a disappointed civic activist. And we felt like the board and the county council were passing us back and forth. The board would blame the county council for not funding the school. The county council would blame the board for not advocating for the school. Mm-hmm. And I guess as a community, we felt like our The board and the county council weren't representing us well. They weren't talking to each other. It was just became a very frustrating experience. Mm-hmm. And at the same time in our community, there was a lot of concern about the creation of the Northeast Consortium. What was that going to look like?
What is the Northeast Consortium?
So the Northeast Consortium, as it's turned out, is a consortium now of three schools. It's Blake, Springbrook, and Paint Branch, where...
Those are high schools?
Those are high schools, and students are assigned a base area. So everyone that lives within the boundaries of those three areas are assigned to a school, but then annually you're given an opportunity to choose your school. So there's a lottery process. So you're guaranteed your base school, but then you get to choose one of the other schools, and each school has distinctive signature programs. So Blake may have has a performing arts program. Paint Branch is more into healthcare careers. Springbrook is more technology and IB, and those programs were created as a way of moving students around.
Are students driving that change, or are the parents driving where the students go? Are there really many 14-year-olds saying, I really need to be in the pre-health career high school?
I'd say it's a combination of the student choice, but I think the parents are also involved. But mm-hmm. and there's a similar program in the Down County. So there you have five schools in the Down County consortium. So it's Blair, Einstein, Kennedy, Northwood, and Wheaton. So it's the same model. But the mm-hmm. Northeast Consortium was the first model. It was very contentious at the time. Originally, Sherwood was supposed to be part of the Northeast Consortium. A lot of this was being driven at the time by how do you balance the demographics of the communities. The Sherwood area was far whiter and mm-hmm. less diverse. And, you know, the idea was how do you get students from, you know, without the boundary process or just drawing boundaries for the new high school. If the system had just drawn boundaries for Blake at the time, given the location of where Blake was, mm-hmm. Blake would have looked like it would have probably drawn a lot of the white and middle-class populations away from Springbrook and Paint Branch. And the system, that's why the system was creating this consortium, to try and balance demographics through a choice process as opposed to just forcing, boundaries that...
So was there almost implied segregation, is what you're saying?
Well, I mean, if the system, I wasn't a decision maker at the time. I mean, if the system had just drawn boundaries, I think that it would have created a more unequal,
demographic
distribution at the new high school that the system tried to avoid by doing a choice model.
Do people self-segregate demographically? Do you tend to have communities of one demographic or another in certain areas of the county?
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, there's
definitely... Do people self-segregate in a way, and then the schools are trying to, would you say, intentionally or potentially artificially make it more diverse within a student body for the benefit of the students?
I think that is the goal, to try and avoid drawing boundaries that create...
Because it's part of the education process for one student of a certain background to be exposed to another student of another background.
Correct.
Okay. So there was this whole process.
So there was this process that was being proposed, and there were folks that were unhappy with how this was, between the elementary issue and the high school issue. It created a lot of concern in our community. Mm-hmm. What we ended up, I wasn't the leader, I was one of the leaders, eventually created a PAC called the Northeast Montgomery Political Action Committee. And there was the sense that the goal of our PAC was going to be electing folks to the Board of Ed and the County Council that would represent our community, because there was the sense at the time that, well, I mean, if you look at the greater Alney community in our area of the county, we weren't represented on the board or on the county council. And
so did you each make personal financial contributions to this political action committee?
There was a limited amount, but we did other things for fundraising.
Okay.
But it was actually fairly successful for several years. We did endorsements in Board of Ed and County Council races, all the elected officials. I mean, to have a nonpartisan citizens group mm-hmm. that would get involved in politics, would, you know, make endorsements, would work the polls, would support different candidates. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of times candidates, after they would get endorsements by our group, would actually contribute to the PAC because they knew, you know, we would use those funds to get the word out that, oh, you know, we support yeah. such and such, you right. know, for elected office.
So that would be third party validation that would help those candidates increase their credibility in the eyes of voters.
Right. Absolutely. Okay. So that I'd say for several election cycles, our PAC survived. I mean, eventually things sort of, and we got involved in issues other than just school issues.
Were you able to get what you wanted, basically? I mean, were you over time able to see that? Well, what was it that you wanted with this Northeast Consortium? You wanted more integration of students with the boundaries?
Well, I think with the Northeast Consortium, that's what the school system wanted. I think that there were concerns after the consortium was created. There were folks, there were kids from Sherwood that were assigned to the new school. The question was whether or not, at least for the first year, some of them could have stayed at Sherwood. I know that was a big issue back then. But I think going forward, that group was more like, as new issues come along, new facilities yeah. issues, growth issues, we just wanted to make sure that our community was represented. So
what was the biggest, I guess, win for this political action committee of yours?
You know, it's hard to say. I think just the fact that folks knew about us and considered us, and
you became a player.
We were a player.
And did you have an impact on policy?
It's hard to say. I mean, I think that folks certainly were aware of us and had to consider the points that we were making on different issues and factor in our concerns.
You gave your neighborhood a seat at the table.
Absolutely.
So then eventually, somehow, you became the guy representing all me.
So eventually, I became more active than I probably would have otherwise been in PTA.
And this is in addition to your job at the VA.
This is in addition to the job at the VA.
This is like evenings and weekends.
This is evenings and weekends. Okay. So in addition to the job at the VA, so I became a president of the Far Corps PTA. I was, just went up the ladder in terms of PTA positions. So became from a PTA president to a cluster coordinator to an area vice president. Uh-huh. And, all the while my kids are growing up in the system. And, so then we got to the point where my kids were graduating, aging out of the system, and the question was, well, do I want to continue as a PTA person,
right,
or do I want to take what I've learned and get involved in Board of Ed? And that's really where I made the choice to sort of take what I learned and run for Board of Ed. I actually put it, there was actually two times there was a vacancy on the Board of Ed, I guess when Reggie Felton, who was on the board, left the board because he moved there. So there was an opening the way it works, the board, if there's a vacancy, the board can appoint to fill a vacancy. I put in for the vacancy, but I wasn't chosen. But then I sort of got, okay, well, I started to think about, whether or not this is something I really, do I really want to do the campaigning, the electioneering and all that? So I did run in 2006. I ran against Nancy Navarro, who actually did get appointed to the seat back in 2006 when there was the vacancy. I lost then, but then, then the at-large seat opened up in 2008 and I ran then and then, I was successful.
So you've been on the Board of Education for 8 years.
8 years.
So two four-year terms, and let's see. And so you hadn't had necessarily a lifetime calling for politics, but through the interests of your children, you developed an expertise in a certain policy area, became aware of the community's concerns, and then used that expertise and knowledge and previous advocacy experience to become an elected advocate yourself for those same changes. That's basically the
I'm
process.
I'm basically saying I went from being the one switching positions from being someone advocating to being someone deciding, because I felt like, you know, that's...
So what was it like to be on the other side of the table and to have other people from around the county advocate for changes and trying to convince you to change your vote?
So it was interesting. Look, it's an interesting process, and it's I felt prepared in a sense, but until you really get into the seat and realize how, you know, I knew my little area of the county and
yeah.
all, and I think I came in with a good understanding of, you know, what is our budget, our operating budget, our capital budget. But it certainly was, you learn so much
yeah.
much about what you don't know
uh-huh.
once you get in there. But yeah, it's definitely, it's interesting. And, but I think it sort of helps because you can sort of filter out sometimes, you know, what's the agenda of, you know, of folks when they are advocating on different issues.
What was your agenda? What were you trying to do? What was your top priority?
You know, it's hard to say. I mean, I came on, you know, so, I mean, there would be things where I would be frustrated, you know, watching the board.
What would frustrate you?
Sometimes I would think that when staff would give responses, maybe they would influence a board's decision based on the responses, that sometimes that there would be half of an answer or half of the truth, and you sit there
while you're an advocate or a member.
Well, I'm an advocate. And you say, you know, they're not really telling the whole story here.
Uh-huh.
And maybe if they really told the whole picture, there would be a difference. I think there was, you know, like I said, there was the frustration at the time of why doesn't the council and the board just talk to each other? I mean, so they point fingers mm-hmm. and. You know, and can't there be a better process by which these decisions are made? Because it seems like decisions are made in a vacuum, in silos, and just a frustration as a community member watching our elected officials point fingers at each other and blame each other. I got in there, and that's one of the things I was saying, okay, let's...
Structural problems.
You know, how do you fix these things? You know,
did you do it, or did you do it? How many members are on the Board of Education?
So there are 7 adults and 1 student member.
Okay, so 8 members of the board.
8 members of the board,
and you're 1 of 8. And then how do you? But of course, the student member of the board doesn't vote on the budget.
He does now.
Oh, he does now. Okay, so could even be a tie.
Could even be a tie.
But so you
which
have
is a whole conversation for another day now.
So we have structural frustrations. We have staff that aren't telling the whole story when you
or
were there.
The perception is that you're not telling the whole story.
Did you change that when you were there?
So you attempt to change that. You know what I mean? I think that's been something that over time we have tried to chip away at in terms of the answers that we get. You know, it can be, you know, the way the board is set up, you said we have 7, 8, counting the student member, we have 3 professional staff.
Uh-huh.
And
oh, wow. It's not very much.
It's not very much. And so we rely on the superintendent's staff, really.
How many does he have?
Well, I mean, he's got... You know, I can't say. I mean, he's got. I mean,
more
in terms
than 3.
Of, more than 3. I mean, in terms of his budget office, in terms of facilities, in terms of all the folks that support the superintendent.
Dozens of people.
Yeah, dozens.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Not less than 100. Yeah. More than 12.
Right. Right.
Okay.
Lots of folks.
Okay.
You know, if we ask questions, you know, depending on trying to say who in the system is actually preparing the answer.
But who hires and fires the superintendent?
The board hires and fires the superintendent.
So he's accountable to you.
So he is accountable to the board. But structurally, so you come on the board and you're okay, the new board member, and you say, oh, I want to fix this. And
yeah.
You quickly... Well, you know, who are you?
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, we have a very successful system here, and we've done things a certain way for many years, and there is no argument, or at least I don't think there's much argument, that we are were, especially when I came on the board, one of the most successful school systems in the country.
So there's not too much you want to change and rock the boat because you don't want to mess with success.
I mean, you want to come on and say, I want to fix things. But I think there's this pushback of...
Don't fix it if it ain't broke.
Don't fix it if it ain't broke. You know, we got this way doing things in a certain manner. We had a very successful superintendent when I came on, Jerry Wiest, who was had a way of doing things. You know, for when I came on, he had been superintendent for 10 years. So there was a way in which things got done. So to...
Is it fair to say that one of the greatest responsibilities of a member of the Board of Education in Montgomery County is to just keep the operations going and make sure that you maintain the system?
Well, certainly you don't want to break the system.
Yeah.
And I think that's really, you know, that's, I think that's really the
progress is nice, but you want to prevent backsliding.
You don't want to, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. But at the same time, you know that there are challenges. You know there are things that you come in and say, okay, you know, can't we do things better? But that's the challenge of, as a single board member coming into a new board, into a board that has a way of doing business, as a system that's doing business, you know, how do you really effectuate change?
So we're nearing the end of the podcast and just like to ask you for a moment to reflect on your years of service. Why is it that you've done this? Clearly, how much do you get paid as a Board of Education member?
So I was on the old pay scale. It got increased, but I was getting paid $18,000.
$18,000 a year for what could potentially, in terms of time commitment, be a full-time job.
Easily, a full-time job.
In addition, actually, to your real full-time job. So why?
So you try to make a difference. You know, I mean, I've always been pretty proud of the fact that I was, okay, on the governing board on, I would say, one of the best schools. You know, Maryland has one of the best, you know, claimed as one of the best state school systems around. Mm-hmm. And I think Montgomery County is probably
the jewel in that crown.
The jewel in that crown. So you could sit there and say, this may be the best system in the country.
Yeah.
Hard to say. I mean, it's hard to, you know,
but
based
among
on
the
what,
best.
Certainly among the best. So there's a certain element of pride saying, okay, I am part of the governing body of a system that is probably one of the best. So I think I can take, you know, pride in that. I think that, you know, despite whatever challenges we've had over the last, you know, 8 years of time that I've been on the board, I mean, you know, yeah, absolutely, we've had challenges. But I think that to the extent that I have anything that I've advocated for, differences we made in terms of how the board operates, the relationship with the superintendent, mm-hmm. the relationship with our staff in terms of funding decisions we've made and all that, you know, I'm pretty proud of what I've done, and, you know, it just gives me pleasure.
So that has been Phil Kaufman, at-large Board of Education member for Montgomery County Public Schools, who speaks about service, taking pride in service, being able to facilitate the delivery of a high-quality education to students in one of the largest and highest-quality school systems in the United States, and being a part of some enterprise that's greater than yourself that is successful at delivering such high-quality services to its beneficiaries, the students, is something that's worthwhile. So that has been episode 53 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll talk to you next time.